Today at Reader's Corner, Thomas Dyja, author of The Third Coast, When Chicago Built the American Dream.
I think that's one of the reasons why so many of these things just came out of the city. Its senses of being a host to America also helped it be a salesman to America. But that comes from a Chicago mindset, I think. In Chicago, everybody gets to come to the party. The fact that Chicago was so segregated, Black Chicago really developed a lot of its own culture and business. Chicago and Chicagoland is still this massive heartland market, a global market, a global city, but I think it's right now still trying to figure out what exactly it is.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Back in the early 1930s, Chicago had the distinction of being the fourth largest metropolis in the world. The city was a melting pot of race, ethnicity, and culture, and a place where some of the world's most celebrated architects, writers, musicians, and entrepreneurs would find their inspiration. In his book, The Third Coast, When Chicago Built the American Dream, Thomas Dyja makes the case that much of what defined America, particularly from the end of World War II until 1960, came from Chicago. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Thomas Dyja. He was born and raised on the northwest side of the city and is a third-generation Chicagoan. The Third Coast won the Chicago Tribune's Heartland Prize and was named a New York Times notable book. It's now out in paperback. Mr. Dyja joins us by phone for this interview. Thomas Dyja, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Well, I'm very honored to be here. Thank you.
Tom, when I started reading your book, when I first saw it in the bookstore, I picked it up because of my years in Chicago. I thought, oh, I'm going to learn something about the city I grew to love over the years and then left. And when I got into the book, I found that it's much more than just a book about Chicago. Your subtitle says it well, When Chicago Built the American Dream. But also, you call it the Third Coast. Is that your appellation? I mean, I think you... are you the inventor of the Third Coast?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, my agent ran that idea. She kind of threw that phrase out at me when I was thinking about this idea, and I just like felt, ooh, that exactly nailed it. But the fact is, other people, it's kind of an occasional name that comes up because of the Third Coast being the shores of Lake Michigan in a way.
Right.
And, you know, the lake, as you know, and anybody who's been there, the lake has a really important presence in Chicago, and it just seemed like a great place to kind of hang the idea on right there. But, you know, you're talking about Chicago as being really a national story, and this book being a national story. I think what we lost to a certain degree and what we lost in America is this kind of central place of Chicago. And during the period that I write about, it really is the meeting place of America. It's the original Las Vegas. If you were taking a train across America coast to coast, you literally had to get off the train in Chicago and switch. It was a place where everyone met in America. And I think that's one of the reasons why so many of these things just came out of the city, is that Chicago is used to kind of getting to know the rest of the country in a way you didn't have to if you're on the East Coast or the West Coast. Mm-hmm. So it senses a place where as being a host to America also helped it be a salesman to America. You know, Montgomery Ward's came out of there, the kind of the original Amazon, right? Catalog sales.
That's right.
So it's a real it's centrality, you know, to America. Losing that, I think, was kind of the beginning of a very divisive period in America. We started to get that kind of East Coast, West Coast, and then the heartland flyover state separation, which really existed less in this period when Chicago was in the middle producing new things.
So I guess if I was the mayor of Chicago, I'd probably say, now, wait a minute, Tom. I mean, okay, so they're not coming through on the trains, but they're coming into O'Hare, which is still the nation's crossroads, at least one of them. Atlanta competes with it. And downtown, wow, the architecture today. Have you seen Millennium Park lately?
Right.
No, so
it's remarkable, sure.
There's obviously, I'm sure there's some Chicagoans who would probably say, Tom, can you write the next volume of this and bring us up to date?
Right. Well, you know, the next, and there is a lot of interesting stuff that certainly happens. You know, someone, Jane Byrne, who recently passed, the former mayor of Chicago, who is still a pioneer decades after her election as the first woman mayor of a major city in the United States. You know, the problem is when you look at New York and Los Angeles from, let's say, the post-war until now, you know, these are cities that are adding people. There's a million more people in New York than there were 30 years ago. Many more even compared, you know, when you put Los Angeles in there. Chicago is right now kind of holding ground. But from the period I write about to where it is now, it's lost something like 800,000 people. I think it has certainly weathered the worst of the whole Rust Belt post-industrialization that all of America, or certainly the kind of Northeast, went through in the 70s and 80s. But it still, I think, hasn't found exactly what that new thing is going to be. You know, Washington is the center of government, and New York is communications, and L.A. is a media place, and Seattle is kind of computers in the Bay Area. And what Chicago and Chicagoland is still this massive heartland market, a global market, a global city. But I think it's right now still trying to figure out now what exactly it is, because its role as a crossroads is just simply not the same as it was in this period from, you know, the 40s and 50s that I'm writing about.
Well, one of the areas that certainly pioneered in early TV and radio, obviously Chicago, was at the center of some of the earliest personalities that became known nationwide. I was a kid growing up in St. Louis, and I'm just old enough to remember my mother every morning tuning into Don McNeil. And I never really understood as a kid that Don McNeil was broadcasting right out of the city of Chicago. And by the way, I had to Google this to find out, so I'm no expert on Chicago, Tom. But I found out that Don McNeil is the longest-running network entertainment MC in history, surpassing Johnny Carson and Bob Barker. Wow. So tell us about some of these folks who really started early TV and radio off from Chicago.
Yeah, I mean, the radio kind of is a little earlier than the period of the book. But, you know, radio really was a dry run for television, which was something I didn't really know until I started working on this. I mean, they knew, the people like Sarnoff and the big network communications people knew that television was coming. And radio was kind of a dry run to set up the networks and some of the technology for it. And the cost of producing shows on the East Coast and the West Coast was very high. So they came to Chicago, which had important kind of logistical wiring connection importance, but they could also produce shows much more cheaply. So things like soap operas were created in Chicago as a cheap form of programming. Country music really was something that was popularized, believe it or not by the Grand Ole Opry, but by a show in Chicago on WABC, which was then Prairie Farmer Network. It was, Chicago had, because it was not just an industrial powerhouse, but an agricultural powerhouse. This was a city that was deeply in touch with the heartland, and the connection to the country music was natural. Most huge number, millions of farmers were listening to shows coming out of Chicago. So it had a really big impact in radio. And then as television came along, early television, really the same thing happened. East Coast and West Coast were making very expensive shows. The East Coast shows were a little more kind of Broadway oriented in a way. They kind of replicated vaudeville, things like that. The shows that were on the West Coast were a little more film oriented because that's what the media was coming out there. So, but these were really expensive. You know, an episode of your show of shows was something like $85,000 to produce. So they looked to Chicago for the same thing, which was give us something different and cheaper. And what came out of Chicago in the early 50s and late 40s was a kind of program that was really simple. It was people playing with the medium and kind of improvising. Really, a huge amount of the shows were things that were made up on the fly. Dave Garraway was given a variety show. He had been a disc jockey in Chicago, and he had this very low kind of late-night voice. But he really connected with listeners. And so he was given a show that brought everyone in to kind of into television. He brought, because he didn't get a lot of money to produce it, they would take the camera behind the scenes and show how everything worked, which was a really important thing as people were trying to learn what television was in the 50s. So this show was such a big success that NBC brought him to New York, and he was the host of a show called The Today Show, which was a remarkable idea that people would want to watch TV first thing they woke up. But that ended up such a hit that then they created another show called The Tonight Show. So that idea of the talk show was very much also a part of kind of a Chicago ethos or a Chicago aesthetic. In Chicago, they were willing to sit down and watch people talk to each other or get involved with improv, which is something that comes out with the Compass Theater. So a huge amount of comedy in America today comes out of a theater project from 1955 in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. And that reminds me of a sad note. Mike Nichols recently passed away, and I believe he was associated with the Compass Theater, wasn't he?
He was, yeah. I mean, he was one of the central people of it. He and Elaine May, along with a number of other people, he had grown up in New York and went to the University of Chicago. One of his roommates was the philosopher Susan Sontag. But the University of Chicago right then was kind of the last years of a really remarkable period under Robert M. Hutchins, who had really made liberal arts in a very exciting and unusual way of pursuing that kind of education, the hallmark of the school. And theater, they had a very intense, small but intense theater scene at the University of Chicago that Nichols had been a part of. He left Chicago for a while, went to study at the Actors Studio. Then he came back and joined the Compass Theater, which was kind of based on the theater games of a woman named Viola Spolin. And the idea was that rather than producing kind of big old plays, you know, reading lines off of the script up there, instead it created scenes for the actors to improvise. And it was almost like playing a game where you'd have an idea or a scenario and the actors would play off of each other. So the person that he really connected with the most was Elaine May, who is still alive happily. But the two of them just created this great partnership that after a couple of years when the Compass Theater kind of imploded on its own, you know, from personalities and creative reasons, the two of them went off and created a Broadway show called An Evening with Nichols and May, and they became immediate American comedy stars. But out of the Compass Theater came and Second City, which in 59 was created in Chicago. You get John Belushi, Bill Murray, Joan Rivers, Alan Alda, Steve Carell, Stephen Colbert, all these people, Tina Fey. It's just it is, I think, still the nursery of American comedy now. Mm-hmm. And certainly Mike Nichols was and Elaine May were at the beginning of it and kind of on the highbrow end of it. But it's an important piece of what Chicago gave to America during this period. And for reasons that I think are so unique to Chicago. I don't think improv would take off in the same way. It's certainly popular everywhere now, but Chicago was the place where it was born fundamentally as a kind of creative entertainment.
You're listening to Thomas Dijah. He's the author of The Third Coast, When Chicago Built the American Dream. Well, you know, when you mentioned the University of Chicago and Mike Nichols coming down from New York to attend, it reminded me of a section of your book where you talk about the rise of the University of Chicago. Here at Boise State a few years ago, we won the Fiesta Bowl, beating Oklahoma by 1 point. And overnight, we were this national acclaimed university that had knocked off the big guy. And we decided to use it to build our academic credibility and our academic integrity. And over the recent years, we've been able to do that. But I'm reading about the University of Chicago, and you're telling us that Robert Hutchins and the football coach Amos Alonzo Stagg pretty much did the same thing, because in those early days, if a kid couldn't get into Princeton or Yale, then they'd go to the University of Chicago. Today, of course, it's a world-class university, but we don't oftentimes think that once upon a time, the University of Chicago actually built itself up out of football.
Well, they're actually the original example of it, because this, you know, as we think of University of Chicago now, it's this, you know, very high-powered, sure, Nobel Prize cabinet kind of school, you know. But early on, it was a jock school. It was a kind of commuter school, and it was not highly regarded. And the way that, and this is before Hutchins comes aboard, Stagg is brought in and builds a football program there, and they really are the first school to do that, to kind of do what you're talking about, to back end, to get visibility through its football program, and they become the biggest, best football team. The Monsters in the Midway was not the Bears. It was the University of Chicago Maroons. And so it becomes actually a bit of a party school. You know, it's full of frats, and it becomes very popular, and it has very deep, strong academic kind of graduate programs. A lot of, you know, John Dewey, these kind of cornerstone foundational people in American thought are there, but its undergrad program is still this kind of football party thing. And then Hutchins comes along in 29, he's this wunderkind, and gets rid of the football program, which by a certain point has really, to be perfectly honest, gotten pretty bad.
I won't be doing that, by the way.
Exactly. It's losing, you know, 50 to nothing. And it's just every week, it's just getting destroyed. And so Hutchins is the one who pulls the plug on big football at the University of Chicago. And so Chicagoland then begins to look at another school, which has a sort of famous football program as well, and that's Notre Dame. And so Notre Dame's popularity in kind of the Chicago area really begins after the University of Chicago pulls the plug on their football program. So just to say, I think they're D3 or D2. They do play football now at the University of Chicago again, mm-hmm. but certainly not D1 level. But it is interesting that's been a real dance of how to handle sports. But they were ahead of everybody else on that.
Let's just go down the list of some really interesting people that did more than just establish a reputation for themselves, but really changed the course of our culture. And Ray Kroc comes to mind.
Right.
And McDonald's hamburgers. Tell us about that.
You know, Ray Kroc grew up in Chicago. One of his friends when he was, or actually who he met in World War I as he was working with an ambulance corps, was another Chicagoan named Walt Disney. And Ray Kroc always wanted to, he kind of bounced around. He was a lounge pianist and stuff. He sold swampland in the Everglades. He kind of bounced around guy. And he finally got involved selling paper cups and Mixmasters and things like this. And so he gets up to about 50, and he's doing fine for himself. But what he hasn't done is made the big score. And he's selling Mixmasters, as I said, and there's one account out in California, San Bernardino. Most places have maybe one or two Mixmasters to make, you know, milkshakes. There's a place that has 40 of them, and they're running constantly. And he has to go see this place that's run by these brothers called the McDonald Brothers. And, you know, cars are happening. The post-war car world and car fascination is beginning. And this place is full of people who are driving to go to this burger place. So he makes a deal with the brothers to franchise McDonald's. So the thing is, Ray Kroc doesn't invent McDonald's, but the brothers don't really care that much about the business. I mean, they like the money, but they're not that interested in selling it. It's Kroc who starts the kind of first franchise McDonald's in Des Plaines, a suburb right outside of the city limits. And he's obsessed with it, with this idea of kind of quality food, which we don't necessarily associate with McDonald's now, but at the time, food places were, you know, grinding chicken hearts, or there'd be a hole in the middle of the patty. I mean, it was not a kind of guaranteed reasonable meal at these places. And Kroc wanted to provide quality food, but also he wanted to give people who were not interested in joining kind of that wave of corporate America that was going on in the 50s, that man in the gray flannel suit kind of idea of how to do things. He wanted to give people, small businessmen, a way to have their own business, but also kind of realize some of the values, those economies of scale that you get by being a big business. So he was a really ethical businessman. So even though we think of McDonald's as being this kind of megalith company, it was founded on ideas of small is beautiful and high quality products. So he's a really interesting guy, I think, and also matches in certain ways Mayor Daley in a kind of machine attitude towards producing stuff, and which was empowering for people on one level, but on another kind of enforced a certain hierarchical power over people as well. The organization was sometimes bigger than the people, and I think McDonald's kind of grew out of that sense of being a little guy company, which it started as.
Today we're talking to Thomas Dyja, the author of The Third Coast, When Chicago Built the American Dream. What role does the Chicago architect Mies van der Rohe play in the history of American architecture and the impact that he's had on the profession?
He's big. I mean, I think when you think of glass and steel architecture, the two important, the greatest names really are Le Corbusier, the French architect, who is probably, in the world of pioneering, maybe a step ahead of Mies, but it's Mies who comes to the United States from Germany in 1938, a little late in the day, but he comes to IIT, the Illinois Institute of Technology, to run the architecture department. And it's really Mies who brings glass and steel architecture to the United States and makes it kind of institutional friendly. And so what we really, the skyline we have today of, you know, of modern architecture, it's something that I think Mies gave us.
I had the opportunity a few weeks ago to interview Isabel Wilkerson on her book, The Warmth of Other Suns, and we talked about segregated Chicago, about the vast black ghetto that formed on the South Side. I wonder if you could just touch on what comes out of that in the culture, especially the contributions from musicians and artists in those years from the black community.
Well, it's an interesting paradox, I think, in that the fact that Chicago was so segregated, violently so, black Chicago really formed, you know, there were walls around it, you know, not maybe not literally, but it seemed almost so. So rather than a situation, because it wasn't integrated, black Chicago really developed a lot of its own culture and business down there. So you had insurance companies, banks, media, things like Ebony, Jet came out of Chicago, The Defender, probably for a long time the leading black national newspaper. Because there was so much a sense, or they just gave up on the idea of the city being integrated, that idea of Du Boisian, W.E.B. Du Bois idea of kind of creating for ourselves, black Chicago did that and created a whole kind of parallel track of business and culture. Some of the great writers that came out of Chicago through these years, Richard Wright, author of Native Son, was a very major figure. The great poet Gwendolyn Brooks, who for my money is the most overlooked 20th century American poet. Langston Hughes is there. Lorraine Hansberry, Raisin in the Sun. There's certainly in the late 30s, there's a great, I think, that when we talk about the Harlem Renaissance, there is a Chicago Renaissance that is much less concerned with the tuxedos and going to nightclubs and stuff. It is much more worker-oriented and integrated to some degree with writers like the young Nelson Algren, the young Studs Terkel, who are all meeting together at these Jack Reed clubs or John Reed clubs, which were basically funded by the Soviet Union. They were kind of, they weren't communist fronts because they weren't hiding anything. Then this was before World War II. And so there was a really interesting interracial mix going on in the South Side. And so a lot of the black Renaissance comes out of that, but also the broader things that I talk about in the book. People like Nelson Algren and Studs Terkel really had their roots in an unusual period in Chicago where there was some greater level of communication than there between the races than there were for probably 20, 30 years after that. But black Chicago is very different, I think, in some fundamental ways from, say, Harlem and black life in New York, in that it was so concentrated. And because of that, kind of the pluses and minuses of segregation, they ended up with a little bit more political voice because they preserved the voting power of those two wards. And so actually were able to get a little bit more political power than ever existed in New York because those votes mattered in Chicago in a way that they were a little more diffuse in New York.
So when I look back on Hugh Hefner setting up the Playboy Club, if you asked me theoretically where would he do this, I'd probably say, well, L.A. first, New York City second,
And I might come up with Chicago as a third, but I'm not sure. But he didn't go to L.A. and he didn't go to New York City. He went to Chicago. How does that happen?
Well, that's because he grew up in Chicago. You know, he grew up actually not far from where I grew up. So, and his house is still there. And the parks he used to run around in, I did too. So sort of, actually, I was baptized in the place where he was married, St. John Bosco. But, you know, he grew up kind of looking at downtown Chicago as the cool place, you know, the swanky martini drinking kind of part of the world. That's what he saw. And so when he was young, he got married relatively young. And was living in Hyde Park with his wife and his very young daughter. But he had a kind of series of they were all magazine jobs, but they weren't kind of rocketing him to the top. And he had an option to go. Esquire magazine used to be in Chicago, and they were moving to New York. And Esquire was his dream job, but he didn't want to leave Chicago. And so he was walking over one of the bridges over the Chicago River after he had put together a talent show for his high school. And he just said, you know, I'm going to go for it. And he pushes it all in, gets out literally a poker table and puts it in the living room. And he begins to put together this magazine he's been dreaming of forever, which ends up being called Playboy. So, you know, his dreams of leaving Chicago started after Playboy. He just wanted to be in Chicago. And his memories of the places being what I talked about earlier, that place where everybody had to come. Some of the best recording studios were in Chicago. So there was no shortage of great musicians coming. It always had a great music scene. Everybody stopped in Chicago. And he created, through the Playboy Club and the mansion, really the mansion first, this place where all the stars would come. And he was, I think he was on to very much the idea of being kind of the big tree in the prairie, you know. Mm-hmm. He might have just been another guy in New York or Los Angeles, but in Chicago he was able to stand out a little bit more. But he was very tapped into, I think, a sense that Chicago had from being that convention city of bringing everybody into the scene. You know, he really invited and instructed young men who were not interested in hunting and fishing, who were newly wealthy from the kind of expansion of the economy, and he helped them figure out how to buy stuff. How to lead this kind of new, suave, you know, urban lifestyle. And sex was really, certainly the naked ladies were a part of it. And as much as there's that joke, you know, I read it for the articles. In fact, there was truth to that. Learning about how your stereo works and what kind to get and what are, you know, what cheeses and what wines and all these kind of sophisticado elements. You know, Mad Men doesn't exist without Playboy magazine. You know, that disseminated that kind of information long before. But that comes from a Chicago mindset, I think. A New York attitude would have been all about velvet ropes and, you know, well, you're not our type. But in Chicago, everybody gets to come to the party. And Hugh Hefner really opened the doors to that consumer party of post-war America.
Well, Tom, we've run out of time, but I just want to comment. We've barely touched the surface on this book, and I want our listeners to know that if they want a great way to get a lesson on American history in the 20th century through the eyes of one city and the enormous impact it's had on our culture, on our politics, on our economy, on our educational systems, you've got to read The Third Coast, When Chicago Built the American Dream. Thomas Dyja, thank you for being with us today,
too.
Tom.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Thomas Dyja. Next week, Beth Macy, author of Factory Man, How One Furniture Maker Battled Offshoring, Stayed Local, and Helped Save an American Town. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.